This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This special episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit, covering the red carpet premiere of The Hobbit, The Unexpected Journey, is brought to you by Bluehost. Start your own blog or website in minutes for a very low price, just $6.95 per month. You get your own .com domain name, one-click installation of your blog, and you never have to worry about bandwidth. Go to sqpn.com/bluehost for more information. And by the Amazon store. Click on the link on our website before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show.
sqpn.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Welcome to a very special episode of this podcast. There and back again, the beginning of the journey of Bilbo Baggins. It now has begun for all of us because yesterday was the New Zealand premiere. For some of us, it's actually today was the premiere because of all the time zones. The premiere of the first of the three Hobbit movies, The Unexpected Journey. And today we are going to talk about the live event that was broadcast around the world using the internet. It was a live video stream. We've all watched it. We're going to talk about what we saw, what we heard, and of course, we're going to speculate about what it means for the movie that none of us have seen because, well, we're not part of the cast and crew. To talk about this premiere, this red carpet premiere in Wellington, New Zealand, we've got a full crew today. And may I welcome back Mr. Dave Kale. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Father Roderick.
I should have a sound effect with applause because you are one of the hardest working men in the world. Unbelievable. I don't know how you do it. And of course, you've been sorely missed by so many of us. But we've explained time and again that you're just trying to basically live like three lives in one life.
Yeah, kind of.
But we're so elated that you have some emptied some time to be here for this premiere episode of the show. And you've been very busy because you were also part of the whole coverage on Middle Earth Network, and you were in the chat room, and of course you're also hosting the Riddle Game, which now probably at least the first part of the game is coming to an end, coming to a close, because that is basically a show, for those of you that have never listened to it, shame on you, that is talking about what will we see, how will the book translate to the movie, and what will the choices that be that are made. You've been doing that show with Corey Olson and many other prominent bloggers and podcasters in from the world of Tolkien. The movie is out. It has now been seen. So has everybody given you their predictions?
So you must be referring to the email that I sent out late last night. I was on the Riddles in the Dark Predictions Facebook page that some folks set up, and somebody had mentioned that and said like, you guys are probably going to have to like freeze the game now since the movie's been seen. And then I thinking about that and watching through the premiere, I was like, oh crap. Yeah,
like, we're so in trouble now.
It seems inevitable that spoilers will come out. So I sent that sort of panicked email last night to everybody saying, get your predictions in. You know, we need to know just in case if things start leaking out. Well, we'll see. I don't know. The question I had watching the premiere last night was, how many of those people lining the streets in the crowd, how many of them are going to be in the theater, or is it mostly the actors and the media who are watching? Because if it's the latter case, if it's mostly sort of handpicked people watching the premiere, then maybe spoilers won't make it out. Maybe they have maybe people know that if they want to be invited to the next two premieres, that they have to keep their mouths shut.
That might very well be the case. Actually, I've done a lot of searching online to see if there were already reviews up, even like press reviews of the movie. I haven't seen them. So most of the quotes that you find in the articles that appear today, now this might change, of course, in the in the course of today and tomorrow. But most of the early reviews are from the actors and from like the select few directors that were there. I mean, Bryan Singer from the X-Men and other movies.
I saw he was there. That was pretty crazy.
He was like, wow, this was awesome. And now I want to do my movies in, 36 frames per second as well. And
48.
Or 48, yeah. Yes. And so you see a lot of very enthusiastic reviews, but it's all from the people that are already involved in the movies themselves. So perhaps that's on purpose. It does create like an early wave of enthusiasm, and perhaps the more critical reviews will appear later on. Also joining us, you already heard her in the background, is Inge Lutz, our producer and also co-host of The Secrets of Middle-Earth, now also co-host of The Secrets of The Hobbit. Now, you've watched this red carpet premiere just like me this morning on a kind of a repeat of the live stream. What was your first impression?
Yeah, I was amazed at how many people were there on the streets and how long the red carpet was. It was very long. And
probably the longest one in the world.
Yeah, like 500 meters, they said. So 500 yards for those in America. And just exciting to see. And I had a hard time recognizing the actors because I only had seen, the dwarves in costume on the on photos. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that who is that? And then they was like, that's Bomber. I was like, no, you're kidding me.
It is very funny to see them in real life, and also a little bit of a shock. You're like, you're not supposed to wear sunglasses, you know?
Oh, you're not supposed to have a beard, you know, like Elrond.
Yes, yes. But I guess that's always the case with people that you know from the silver screen and from the stories. Once you see them, even in another movie, you're like, that's not right.
Yeah, exactly.
Elrond is that Matrix dude. What is he doing here in Rivendell?
Yeah, Smith, yeah, and he even talks like him. It always feels wrong when I see Elrond in Lord of the Rings. It's like, it's not really Elrond. It's just Aidan Smith in disguise.
Well, perhaps.
It never works for me.
Perhaps Middle-Earth is also part of the Matrix. Who knows? It was a gorgeous day. I mean, the weather couldn't have been better. It was just brilliant. And of course, now New Zealand and Australia, they're heading into the summer, right?
I was jealous because I saw all the people with short sleeves. I was like, I'm so cold. I want to be there.
I was so longing to be in New Zealand. Perhaps next year.
There.
Who knows?
It actually sounded like it was pretty hot. What they kept saying. They kept referring to the long walk down the red carpet and how they were going to be all sweaty and all that kind of stuff.
The sun can be very intense, and also most of them were wearing tuxedos and not very comfortable clothes. You know, they're running around in t-shirts. So I guess all that.
Yeah, lots of the dwarves were alluding also to they were used to it because of their suits.
Yes, absolutely.
Hot as well.
Yes, it was. Yeah. But it was a great event. It was much more entertaining than I thought it would be. I've seen some red carpet events before, like the ones that you have normally before the Oscars, for instance. And it's kind of boring because you've got all that kind of glamour reporting and it's so all sorts of people that I don't know. But this whole event also had a lot of, I think, really good interviews and interesting information. Yeah. And that is why we are here, to kind of distill that information for you. I know that a lot of our listeners have watched the entire thing, but I think it's going to be cool to just go back and take some sound bites and talk about the movies, not just the first movie, but also the movies 2 and 3, based on the comments that were made during all these red carpet interviews. And to kick us off, we start with one of the co-writers of the script, Philippa Boyens. And we know, of course, that Peter Jackson wasn't the only script writer. Also, his wife, a friend, worked on it. And she was kind of almost invisible during the whole event. She didn't even want to come up on stage. But Philippa Boyens is also one of the co-writers. And the three of them have been writing the script for the Lord of the Rings trilogy as well. And here's what she said when asked what the hardest challenge was in kind of writing the scripts for these movies.
Just getting it there was fairly hard, I have to say. I think, in terms of the writing, we just keep writing. We continually write. And so... the whole thing was a challenge, but keeping the tone right, keeping it distinct and separate from The Lord of the Rings, making it its own entity, we, you know, all of those things. But
so they keep writing. You think that once the shooting starts, it's over, but no, they actually keep writing. And from what I've heard, and Inge, you've been also reading a lot of the news surrounding this premiere. From the looks of it, they're still writing for movies 2 and 3, right?
Yes, that's how it appears like. And of course, that makes sense because they haven't shot the Battle of Five Armies yet. So I can imagine that needs to be written partly still.
And another thing
also
that I heard,
there's an extra movie, so they need to probably write extra material for the third movie.
Yes,
as well.
And I heard
Peter Jackson.
I heard them say that not only are they going back to the appendices for that Tolkien wrote himself, but also to the Lord of the Rings book to get more information to kind of squeeze out the last drop that they can use in this trilogy. What are your thoughts about that, Dave?
they've been heavily relying upon the appendix of the Return of the King all along. That was something that was clear from the very beginning, even back years ago, 2-3 years ago, when people first were asking the question, how in God's, it's funny to remember back to when they first announced these films and said they were going to do two movies, and
yes,
people were saying, how on earth are you going to get two movies out of The Hobbit? It's such a short book. There's so little in there. And now, of course, we have three films. And Peter Jackson's answer always consistently was that they were going to use the appendix of the Return of the King and really sort of fill out this story, this grander story of The Hobbit, where it's not just kind of this happenstance adventure that this goofy little hobbit goes on to get treasure with a bunch of dwarves, but it actually connects to the bigger picture of the War of the Ring and the White Council's actions against Sauron and stuff like that. Beyond the appendix, I'm not sure. I suppose actually there's a lot of material that they could be looking at from the chapter of the Council of Elrond, mm-hmm, where they basically sort of do, they go through variously the history of Middle Earth, basically. So because they do touch on a lot of material there about sort of the events surrounding the finding of the ring and then also the White Council. There's a lot of White Council politics that are hit on during the during the Council of Elrond chapter. The other thing I can't help but wonder, I know they don't have the rights to the Silmarillion. Nevertheless, there is this chapter in the Silmarillion called of the Third Age and the Rings of Power, which also describes these events. It's interesting. It's because it's from a different point of view. It's from the point of view of the elves, ostensibly. It gets a lot more. It goes into a lot more detail of kind of the bigger picture as opposed to the details of what's going on with the hobbits. In fact, like for example, Sam Gamgee isn't even mentioned when they talk about Frodo's quest. And there again, they also get into a lot of the politics between the White Council members, and it's hard to I'm sure they must have read it, and even if they're not drawing from it directly because they can't due to rights, it's hard to believe that it wouldn't influence them as they go about writing this.
You can't pretend that nobody knows about that.
Yeah, you can't unread it.
I guess as long as they're not quoting it, they could still draw from it. I don't know. Here's what Philippa Boyens said in an interview yesterday. When Warner Brothers said go for turning it into a trilogy, we were so happy as it allowed us to tell more of these characters' stories, she continued. Particularly Gandalf's story. That's interesting. Most of the extra material is being generated not just from the appendices, but from within the text of The Lord of the Rings self, especially for characters like Radagast, she said. And then she got asked if we could possibly see a return of fan favorite Gollum. And then they asked this to Andy, and he says Gollum is not currently scheduled to come back in the second and third movie, but the fact of the matter is, never say never with Peter. Well, that's interesting. Of course, he has no place.
Hugo Weaving.
Go ahead.
Hugo Weaving told reporters that he isn't making an appearance in the third movie.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that later on when talk about Hugo. But David, what do you think about the chances of Gollum coming back? Because that's something that you talked about during the Riddles podcast as well.
Yes, I think I must have missed that. I didn't. I missed bits and pieces here and there. And they also interviewed each of the actors got interviewed multiple times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Andy Serkis in particular is really funny. They interviewed him right at the beginning of the broadcast, and then they interviewed him an hour later, and they were like, "Boy, you've come a long way." And he said, "Yeah, a whole 250 meters." And apparently I missed this too, but apparently there was footage of him running.
Really?
Right at the end, because I guess they were getting ready to start the premiere, and he was still about halfway down the red carpet. But that's an interesting point. That's something we wondered about on this show, and also in the Riddles in the Dark game. Would Gollum come out of his cave? Would we see him in the later films? Would they involve him in the later storylines? And it seemed at the time we had trepidation. We figured that they would not be able to resist the temptation to bring Gollum out of his cave, which we were fine with, but also to involve him in the later film somehow, have him be following the company and all that kind of stuff. But from what Andy Serkis said, maybe they're not. Interesting.
At least it's not planned right now. Just seeing the reaction of the fans to, you know, him being there and then
impersonating.
Just like, wow, this is such an important marketing tool for them, Gollum.
Yes.
However, I feel that as long as he's involved in the movies, and he is as a second unit director, they can still bring him in for the press stuff, the PR stuff. So in a way, he will still be authorized to do part of the promotion. And imagine that they would invite him as a second unit director on a talk show. Of course, they're going to ask him to do the Gollum impersonation.
So this is actually a really interesting question, because as you point out, Inga, they asked Hugo Weaving the same question. He said, you know, far as I know, I'm not in the next two films. I'm just glad to be in whatever films I can be in. And I don't recall them asking Cate Blanchett this, whether she's in the later films.
True.
But I imagine the same is true of her, since they're probably going to share most of their scenes. And, you know, at the end, when they did the talk and Peter's speech, and he introduced the cast, he started by introducing our old friends. So he brought up Hugo Weaving, Cate Blanchett, you know, people who had been in the previous films. And I wonder if what we're seeing here is in the sort of initial marketing for these films, for this first film, what they're trying to do is connect it to the other Lord of the Rings film. So, hey, here's Elijah Wood and Cate Blanchett. Remember, they were in Lord of the Rings. Same characters coming back for this one. But by a year from now, when we get to the second film, we'll be familiar enough with the Hobbit characters, the dwarves, Bilbo, etc., that they can stand on their own. And so maybe they won't actually bring these other characters back, because maybe they will want those films to kind of move on from the Lord of the Rings connections and be their own
thing. Well, and keep in mind that there is one person that they can bring in, even for the second movie, to make that connection, who wasn't here. But who is going to feature, who's going to have a pretty important role in at least the second, but I also think in the third movie, and that is Orlando Bloom. He was not there, but of course we know that once they get to Mirkwood, his role will be pretty substantial, I think. And so that's another card that they have that they can play later on to make that connection. So I think you're right. Yeah, they're just... like right now, they want to get the message out, and you could tell from the reaction of the crowd that all the old favorites were all like, "Wow, yeah, it's him, it's Andy Serkis," and then we have this dwarf played by Peter Hambleton, and I was like, "Oh yeah, that's great too, yeah, sure."
It ties also nicely in with what Philip Boyens said, because they have been writing The Hobbit to make it different from the Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
So what I think what they are doing is just first keep the connection and loosely disconnect it from Lord of the Rings.
So. Yeah, probably. Well, yep. let's go to a short clip by Martin Freeman, who was one of the first to be interviewed, and he talks about his involvement in the movie and then about the first scene that he shot. And this was way back at the beginning when we were young podcasters, just barely knowing what kind of adventure we were undertaking ourselves.
How are you feeling after you've seen the film? Have you seen the film at all in its final cut?
I saw it two or three nights ago, yeah, and it's beautiful, yeah. I'm really, really pleased with it. I'm pleased for Peter. I'm pleased for all of us. Yeah, it was a lot of work and a lot of hard slog and time and love. And it's a beautiful film, yeah.
The first scene that you shot was with Gollum in his cave. What was that like?
It's fantastic. Working with a brilliant actor on one of the most sort of pivotal scenes of the book and of the film. It was glorious for me because it helped me find who Bilbo was, you know. And Andy, yeah, Andy always brings out the best in you, you know. He's great.
So, Martin Freeman, about his first scene being the Riddles game, do you think that this could be a risk that he really didn't know that much about his character yet, and then they have to do this pivotal scene? Or is it an advantage that they started with this one? What do you all think?
I couldn't even begin to say. We were talking about this, if you recall, however many years ago it was when they first announced this, like, yeah, all right, so filming for the movie has started, and we're going to start with the Riddle game, one of the most pivotal scenes of the thing. We're going to launch right in. These guys haven't been around, you know. Martin Freeman hasn't played this character on screen yet. Andy Serkis hasn't played Gollum in 10 years, so we're going to warm them up with the Riddle game. And I recall us saying, like, wow, man, that seems like a risk.
That's my first reaction as well.
Yeah.
Not to mention that Martin Freeman has said multiple times that he wasn't too familiar with the world of Tolkien.
Yep.
And so,
yeah, he's one of the people that said that he became a fan through his participation in the films.
Yeah. But that could be an advantage because this still takes place in the beginning of the story. And so, in a way, Martin Freeman is like Bilbo, who has embarked on this adventure, but really totally unprepared and kind of naive, perhaps, but very much kind of down to earth and calm. And I love that little exchange that we saw in the trailer where, you know, and where Gollum says, and if he loses, we eats it. And then he's like, fair enough. You can only say that if you don't know much about Gollum and about Middle Earth.
That's true.
So in a way, perhaps it helped him.
Yeah, and I suppose logistically this makes sense. As opposed to starting your filming, like, imagine if the first scene they had filmed had been one with him and the dwarves. Then you've got 13 actors who have, you know, there are actually 14 actors who have never been on this film, never played these characters, don't know what's going on, and that's probably a lot more chaos. Whereas here you've got one actor who's a veteran, you know, Andy Serkis, who's played this character before, and even though he needs to warm up, his comments were really interesting, by the way. You know, he can kind of help Martin Freeman ease into it. So I think that makes sense.
Yeah. And also in the storyline, Bilbo has this swings between his back inside and his took side. And you see that his took side takes over after he leaves the cave.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And has the ring. So this is also, from that point of view, a logical point of view to start with, because he's kind of hanging in the middle.
Yep.
From between Took and Baggins.
Yep. The only other scene I could imagine them starting with is that first scene at the beginning of the book when Gandalf shows up and says good morning, and they get into that long debate about what's the meaning of good morning.
If that is even in the film, we don't know.
So what did you think about what Andy Serkis said about, or maybe we haven't gotten there. Maybe
we'll get there. He's two quotes away. But
all right.
I'm going to do this in the right chronological order so that our listeners don't have the feeling that they're missing out on stuff. Let's listen to Beaufort, played by we're not going to listen to Beaufort, but to James Nesbitt, who plays Beaufort. And he talks about kind of the frenzy surrounding this production and how it is to kind of step into that.
In the film and in the book, of course, the dwarves go on this journey, but we as actors were doing the same thing. We had to meet and get to know each other, go on this journey. There were challenges ahead. There were the odd fights and quarrels. But but we've come through it, and of course we've got two more films to get through. But it's a challenging and different situation to be involved in, you know, because you're not quite sure what's going on a lot of the time. But somehow Peter and Fran control this enormous thing at the far end of the world, but they do it with grace and with generosity.
Grace and generosity. I thought it was such a beautiful quote and such a nice thing to say, because I think it's true. It's not just the usual stuff that actors say about that director as long as they're under contract. Yeah, he's a great guy. From what we've seen in the production videos, there seems to be this grace. You see these incredibly dedicated people that must work around the clock. And at the same time, I don't know about you, but I feel that if I would meet Peter Jackson tomorrow, I'd feel totally at ease, because he feels very much also like a family man. And you see that in the way that he treats his daughter. You know, his daughter was there at the beginning of the live stream, and then you're reminded that, wait a minute, this is also a guy who has a family, and they're all part of this adventure. But in a way, his fatherly side also extends to his actors, and it was great to hear all these actors one by one say the same thing, that Peter Jackson just is so accommodating, so more than just a director, and I think that is part of what this movie and this story needs, because ultimately I think this story of The Hobbit is about friendship and about family, and you know, Bilbo becoming part of this dwarven family in a way, and then the dwarves becoming a little bit of a part of the Hobbit family, and it's kind of uniting all these different races in the world of Middle Earth.
Mm-hmm. You hear that from many different actors, that they say, "Yeah, I've been part of a big family," and also I don't remember who said it, but they were rehearsing outside to do the squat, yes. How to move as a squat. And yeah, so I can see also they have a hard time now to go and go on with their business, because yeah. it's you're in Middle Earth while filming that, I imagine.
I think so too. But they will be back for at least two more movies, so they are going to experience what a lot of the actors from the Lord of the Rings trilogy have also been able to, you know, experience. It's that entire country of New Zealand is now kind of part of your family. They're heroes there.
Yeah, one of the actors also said that what he liked about New Zealand is that there's no such thing as a fan frenzy. So even Martin Freeman said, well, yeah, we went from makeup in car through Wellington to the stage where we had to do our stuff. And then people would look at him and were like, oh, he's in costume. Oh, that's Martin Freeman. And then went on with their business.
Yeah, well, that's very much
and that's just funny.
The Kiwi style. It's laid back. It's friendly. It's respectful. And you could feel that respect. But what I'm so amazed by is that, you know, just even in last week, we talked about this, you know, production video 9 and how much they were like working around the clock to get this thing finished. And then still to have that control and that grace. I personally really think that any other director wouldn't have been able to pull it off with this much grace. And I don't know if it's just because of his character or because of the fact that he's doing this with his wife and in a kind of a family atmosphere, because it might also be the Kiwi way to do things. But I can tell the difference with so many other, you know, Hollywood productions and where it's all big business and money and of course, this is big business too, but there seems to be a human touch to the production that is reflected in the movies, and I think that's part of why these movies are so successful. Let's take a look at the leader of the pack of the dwarves. Of course, the great actor Richard Armitage, and from what I've seen during the live stream, I think he is already the most popular actor of the bunch. Wouldn't you agree? Our hot dwarf, and actually they touch upon that as well.
You are one of the centerpieces of this film. You are a heroic figure, and you are constantly seen in this beautiful, golden, heroic way. How did you feel about that?
It wasn't part of the preparation that I did for the character. It was just something that Tolkien had given to the reader, and it was a big shoes to fill. So I just practiced my sword fighting and worked hard to fill those big shoes. Yeah.
You are seen as an action actor, and there was a lot of physical work with this role. How did you prepare?
We did 6 weeks of a boot camp. We did sword fighting. We learned how to move as dwarves. I learned how to sing as a dwarf. So there was quite a lot of preparation.
Tell me about the experience of coming off the film. How was that? Was it very strange after being in this very tight group with these people that you've grown to love?
Yeah, when the plane took off from Wellington for the final time, I was really choked to leave because this place had become my home. But coming back here for this has been incredible. But shaking off the character as well is something which takes a long time. And I think Thorin will live inside of me for a while. I mean, we do come back next year and finish the movie, so hopefully he will.
You talked about seeing the film on Sunday. When you saw the film, what were your first thoughts about Peter Jackson's direction of it?
The thing that really inspires me about Peter is that he is as fascinated with technology and advancing technology in cinema as he is with character and story. And put those two things together, it's something incredible has been created that I've never seen before.
I was part of the media conference this morning, and one of the subjects that came up was working with a green screen. How did you find that?
It requires you to engage your imagination in the same way that you would as if you were doing theatre. And I come from a theatre background, so for me it was really pleasurable. And Pete communicates his vision to you very clearly. His artists give you so much visual reference that it just fires up your imagination, and then you work from there.
Richard, at the risk of objectifying you, how do you feel about being one of the pin-ups in the film?
I thought you were going to say hot dwarf, but I can say we were extremely hot throughout filming. We were swelteringly hot, not unlike today, but I don't know. It was never something I considered when I created the role, but I guess someone that is a hero is going to inspire that.
Dave, what do you think? Is he going to be a good Thorin?
I think he's going to do a great job. I think it'll be, it's clearly not identical to the Thorin in the book, even from the very fact that he's much younger than he is described in the book, or at least he looks much younger than he is described in the book. Like he's a pretty venerable old guy actually in the book, whereas here he looks a little bit younger. It could just be the way he looks, but it sounds like he's doing a great job, and he's doing a very appropriate interpretation of the character for the film. Making him heroic, which allows them to sort of play up some of the conflicts between the competition between Thorin and Gandalf, and then Thorin and Bilbo for leadership of the company. And he is a great actor. I've enjoyed him in a lot of the other things that I've seen him in.
And he seems to be quite an admirer of Tolkien. He was that was a very nice tip of the hat to Tolkien and what he created.
Yes. Sometimes I wonder if these guys have all been coached. They know by the marketing machine for these films know by now how us fans will respond. So they tell them, like, look, what you got to do is make sure you say lots of great stuff about Tolkien as a writer and an author and the kind of story he crafted. And so they know, they just feed us these lines.
I don't know. I don't know.
That idea, I had the same idea. It's like, yeah, they know that. Lots of fans are very apprehensive, first because there were two movies out of one book, and then there were three movies out of one book, and then people were thinking, well, we are getting milked, and of course we are, and then you have to sell that, and that's what they are doing now.
He is alluding to a return next year for more filming, and we know this for this is the case for several other actors as well. This could be the rumored, Battle of Five Armies, or perhaps even, additional dialogue. You don't know. But so he's going to be back for more. So I guess they have to stay in shape.
What I wonder is if they would, now they have three movies, if they would add also, and I don't know if that's being cast or will be cast, so that the aftermath leading up to the Lord of the Rings with the... the son of Bart, the bowman, and also the son of the heirs of the Lonely Mountain. So that it has been a while that I read that, but that they die for each other basically in one of the fronts of the Battle of the Ring. Do you know what I mean?
Sorry, say that again.
I think one of the son of grandson of Bart the bowman becomes king.
Yes, that's correct.
Of Dale.
Yep.
And then one of the descendants of Dine Ironfoot is then a king under the mountain.
Yes.
And then there's this extra front of the Battle of the Ring. So what we see in Lord of the Rings is just one of the fronts. And they die for each other. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I believe it's actually so the Dine who's king at the time of the War of the Ring is actually the same Dine.
Okay.
He lives a nice long time. And then he does die. They say that he falls defending the body of King Brand of Dale, and Brand of course is the grandson of Bard, as you said.
Yeah.
So it is the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, which is the battle out in front of Minas Tirith, is but one of the major battles of the War of the Ring, and is one of the fronts of this war. And one of the other ones happens right at the doorstep of the Lonely Mountain. So,
however, if they would film this, it would feel very much like an epilogue, mm-hmm. especially since the last movie is titled "Here and Back Again." It's, you know, you want the movie to end with the return of Bilbo to the Shire and wrap it up nicely. And if you get this whole, you know, it's like, oh, and wait, and later on. It almost feels like something that would be appropriate for almost like a bridge movie, but a bit too much for this trilogy.
I also think about the multiple endings of the Return of the King. I remember sitting in cinema, I was like, oh, not another ending.
Perhaps. But you disconnect with your main character if you do this, because Bilbo's story arc is finished, unless. There's one way in which they could do that, of course, unless they end the third movie with going back to, I would say, present day Bilbo and Frodo again, and then if that's the big inclusion, you could imagine perhaps like a final part where, you know, Bilbo tells about this, you know, last part of the story, but I don't think the movie needs it or the story needs it.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. I'm skeptical. If they connect this back to the Lord of the Rings films again, it will be through the Frodo frame story most likely, and most likely it will be the connecting thing will be the ring. The other stuff is probably maybe a little too obscure for a film. It's the kind of thing that people like us will eat it up. We'll be like, oh, look what they did. And then the rest of the people will be like, what's going on? Too many characters. So
yeah, could be. Well, speaking of the ring, let's talk about the actor who portrays the creature that is consumed by the ring and its power. And it
All right.
is Andy Serkis. Let's listen.
Andy Serkis has just arrived here on the red carpet, being Gollum, but also second unit director as well. What a challenge that would have been.
Oh, it was an amazing challenge. I mean, and very unexpected. It was an unexpected journey, wasn't it? Because I found out literally a month before we were going to start principal photography, Peter asked me to come down. And so going from a few weeks reprising the role of Gollum, it suddenly became a year and a half's work. So, but it was fun. It was a great challenge.
Now tell me, what was it like doing Gollum again? I read that it sounded like it was doing an impersonation of Gollum, like so many people had improvised and mimicked and imitated him.
That's right. Just for the first couple of days, well, actually, the first day, it was like I thought I was being Gollum, but I realised that actually somewhere in the back of my mind, perhaps I was actually doing an impersonation of impersonation of impersonation of thousands of people's impersonations of Gollum. It was quite weird, but then acting against Martin, you know, we very quickly got into it.
What have these last couple of days been like for you leading up, especially for the people who weren't on the first trilogy?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think for them, they're all very sort of, they're all in shock. They're all aware that something massive is about to happen. And this sort of quiet before the storm was gently getting a little bit more tense. But I think everybody just wants to enjoy themselves now we've got here, you know. I mean, it's been a long road to get here, as you well know. Lots and trials, lots of tribulations, but it's so fantastic to be able to celebrate now.
So that was Andy Serkis in his first interview, and then later on he was interviewed again and even did a Gollum impersonation. It's funny to hear him say that it's kind of hard to be the original Gollum again instead of an impersonator of an impersonator. But
yeah, that's an interesting comment. I was thinking about that last night. I mean, it's kind of amusing, and it's not surprising that it would take him time to warm up. But it's interesting that he has all of these impressions of Gollum that he's heard people do in his head, And I thought, I was thinking about that. And what that really means is that it's what was once a character that he basically created. I mean, that interpretation of Gollum really is what he is his creation, I think, probably, you know, with the filmmakers. But anyway, it was his creation, but after 10 years, the fans have really taken ownership of the character. So many people that can play the character, you know, much like he does, do the impressions of all that, and have done their own interpretations. And it's not his character anymore. We've kind of taken ownership of it, which is pretty interesting.
And it's got to be difficult to go back and find that freshness and realism in, if you can say that, from a digital character. But from what I've seen so far in the trailers, I was very impressed by the Gollum that we get to see in The Hobbit, and I actually felt that it was a better Gollum and a more realistic-looking Gollum than we've seen in The Lord of the Rings. And I wonder if they're going to touch up that first appearance of Gollum now, because that looks so unrealistic and fake and wrong in The Lord of the Rings. But I don't know. It's great to see how different he is from the character that he plays. I'm so impressed by, you know, him being able to pull that off, because Andy Serkis is nothing like Gollum. And to be able to play that riddle scene, which is, you know, that it's going to be, you know, perhaps one of the most important scenes of your character in the entire trilogy. Right after you heard that, oh, by the way, yeah, we'd like you to work on this movie as second unit director for the next year and a half. And he might have already booked his return ticket. That is quite something. And he alluded several times to how hard it had been, how difficult. It's not something that we've seen that much in the production videos so far. The kind of the stress and the things that went wrong. And I don't know what else was going on behind the scenes. I always thought they were having just a great time and everything was going much more smoother than the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but apparently they had their share of trials and tribulations.
I can also see that it's because they're pioneering with a new technique.
Perhaps.
Remember in the last production video, they said, well, we had one building for the Lord of the Rings, which was just standard 2D, 24 frames per second, and now they have 8 buildings for The Hobbit, which is in 3D and 48 frames per second. So I can see that that needs a lot of extra CGI, another layer of organization to make
probably
it work.
Yeah, there were many actors that talked about green screen, and much more than I remember from the like behind-the-scenes stuff that we've seen for the current trilogy. So, perhaps there was much more technology involved, and that makes it more difficult and challenging also in post-production, because, of course, you know, like two-thirds of your screen is green and you still have to kind of figure out what to do in the background. That adds some pressure. Let's go to Keely and Feely, the terrible twins.
You two are the terrible twins, aren't you?
The terrible twins. Maybe.
Terrible actors, yeah, fair enough.
Tell me about the fun you had being the sort of the cutie pie boys together.
The cutie pie. Oh, look, the whole shoot was amazing. Yeah, we had a great... I don't think it was more enjoyable because we were the younger of the dwarves, but it's something else.
When did you actually meet, you two?
Oh, it's
like we've been dating.
I know.
I see it as a bromance.
It is a bit of a bromance, actually, but we're quite proud of that. When did we meet? At the audition, yeah.
Auditioning, and Aidan had already been cast, and
he did all right. Me and Philip had a talk about it. We decided to give him the job, you know, and he's been doing all right since. Right. Not so good in the second movie, but he carries the first one out.
Tell me about the strangest things that you did together, but it is a family show, so we'll keep it clean.
Sticking with the bromance. Some of the strangest things we did together, I don't know. That's a tough one. I don't know. It's anything strange. The whole thing was quite strange. Yeah. You know, killing trolls and giant spiders and orcs on a daily basis is quite strange.
I was standing on Aiden's shoulders. We had to fight some trolls. And I was,
you
know,
on a wire. That's right.
Standing on Aiden's shoulders.
That's right.
Aiden's shoulders.
But that's just how the general kind of day goes. So everything is so wacky anyway. It's hard to pick out the strange bits, you know?
Yeah.
There was a lovely moment at the press conference today where one of the actors was talking about how the dwarves used to go out into a park together and try and move as a
a group together.
Yeah, the dwarven movement classes. We weren't a part of that. Unfortunately, we were. You may have blanked it from the memory, yeah. One of the more embarrassing parts of the preparation for this, walking around with in the squat position, yeah.
Yeah, we had to learn to walk like a dwarf, and it's not a very flattering way to walk.
We never used any of the techniques, so I don't know why we bothered doing it in the first place.
No. And tell me, did you all end up with golden rings that you...
Dude, and I left mine in Dublin.
I forgot mine as well.
Right, okay, it's with me
in spirit, though.
Now, that was a very interesting remark at the end of that interview, the golden rings. I know that in the Riddles in the Dark podcast, there was at least one of the questions that I answered in the nick of time was, will we see the dwarven ring or will we just see the one ring? This lady that is hosting the red carpet premiere is Carol Hirschfield. She has already seen the movie before she did all these interviews. And so her mentioning these golden rings seems to indicate that is something that you would at least perceive. And I don't think that she is like the token Tolkien expert. What do you think, Dave?
That's a fascinating question. I don't have a good answer for it. We've been wondering about this a lot. Particularly regarding the dwarven ring, what role that might play, whether they'll choose to emphasize it or de-emphasize it. I mean, it's not mentioned at all in The Hobbit. I don't even know at the time of the first writing of it whether he even had the concept of the dwarven ring. Although in later on when he's completed the Lord of the Rings, he's not only introduced the concept but started integrating it back into the Hobbit, making that a part of the story. When you introduce the idea of the dwarven ring, you often you have this moment when you're reading that chapter of the Council of Elrond, where Glowin gets up and he's recounting his story, and he's talking about how Balin has gone back to try and retake Moria, and that part of the reason he was doing it was to look for the Ring of Thror. And Gandalf gets up and says, by the way, he's not going to find it because actually Thrain had it, and it was taken from him by Sauron at Dol Guldur. And my reaction to that is always, gee, that's information that could have been useful about 30 years ago, Gandalf. Right. Thanks for sharing, buddy. And I think that that's an example of Tolkien doing his sort of retroactive consistency of retconning the story, and that it can't always be done perfectly. So what we've been wondering is, will they attempt to try and do it slightly better here in this film, where they attempted to actually involve that ring in the storyline? Someone actually at one point on the Tolkien Professor Facebook page proposed the idea of – or actually maybe it was on the Mythgard page somewhere. Somewhere in a comment, someone proposed the idea that they might conflate the Arkenstone with the Dwarven Ring, that maybe the Dwarven Ring will become the treasure that Thorin is looking, the number one treasure he's looking for in Smaug's hoard. But we're skeptical of that idea because we think that it's too inconsistent with the book, and two, they would be missing out on we don't think that Weta will want to pass on the opportunity to create an Arkenstone, because that's going to be an awesome visual effect. So then, what role will the Dwarven Rings play? I don't know. I took the lady's comment, the reporter's comment about Ring, to be just kind of, a general reference to the ring, the One Ring, uh-huh. and the fact that it happened to, I think that is going to be, especially in this first film, because in this first film, all the evidence points to the fact that we're going to get to the rescue by the eagles that happens at the end of the chapter, out of the fire and into the frying pan, or out of the frying pan and into the fire. That's mm-hmm. it. So we're not going to see Smaug, other than maybe some shots at the beginning of glimpses of dragon flame mm-hmm. attacking the Lonely Mountain. Probably not going to see Sauron, as the necromancer very much. We're not going to have any real big villain, other than maybe the Great Goblin will be kind of the villain of this film. Mm-hmm. I won't say that, I was going to call them the uneducated masses, but let's call them the common film-going fan, the person who hasn't read the books deeply like mm-hmm. we have. you know, and I assume that this reporter is probably one of those people. They're going to watch this film through the lens of their previous experiences with the Lord of the Rings films. And one of the things they're going to be looking for is the One Ring. They're going to see that scene with Gollum and Bilbo.
Oh,
and
yes,
and I bet a lot of people are going to come out of the movie with that being the thing that really struck them the most. They're like, oh, Gollum, I recognize him. And oh, there's the One Ring. And then, of course, Bilbo's going to be carrying the ring and using the ring a lot. And I think that it won't be until maybe the third film where people really be watching this as The Hobbit, as a separate story, and not as, you know, sort of Lord of the Rings Jr. in a sense. And I took her question in that sense, that she is still focused on the One Ring and talking about rings and that kind of stuff. But maybe you're right. Maybe that's a hint at something going on with the Dwarven rings. I don't know.
No, did you explain it like that? I think it's more probable that it's just, you know, oh, the souvenir is just, that golden ring. It actually might be very confusing for the viewers if although we've been introduced to the whole concept of there being multiple rings in the prologue to Lord mm-hmm. of the Rings. So but you can't even take that for granted that people still remember that.
Yep.
But
I took it completely different. Mm. I took it like the first trilogy of the Lord of the Rings, all the actors went and get a tattoo together. Mm-hmm. And I just interpreted her question as that they all got a ring, a souvenir, and they
perhaps.
Took home.
Yeah, it might be something that they talked about. There's been a press conference earlier before the red carpet premiere, and perhaps it's something that was mentioned there. She was there too, and multiple times they were referring to what was said there. So perhaps it's something that will still emerge in the press that they all got their golden dwarven ring as a souvenir, and it might not be a story element. Hey,
yeah,
that's
possible.
Let's wrap up with our favorite hobbit from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Frodo, played by Elijah Wood, and I was very glad that he was also interviewed, and he had some very interesting things to say. And that's probably going to be our last quote for today, because I still have like twice the amount of quotes, but we might want to extend that or move that to next week's episode. So let's first listen to what Elijah Wood has to say about his return to Middle-earth.
You know, this is echoing into the past for me, because we'd been down Courtney Place before with Return of the King, so there's a lot of muscle memory, but it's beautiful, and I'm so excited to be a part of this and to be supporting this beautiful film, and so excited for all of the dwarves and for Peter. It's an incredible accomplishment, and it kind of was beyond my expectations. It's really wonderful.
How good is it that it's now three films? You must be very excited that they have enough time to tell so much more of the story.
Yes, indeed. And I think what's great about it is, you know, it was actually, we were doing interviews the other day, and Hugo Weaving was saying that, you know, Lord of the Rings is three films, but in some ways it could have been six or seven or eight, you know, considering how much story there was to tell. The beautiful thing about expounding upon The Hobbit is that it actually allows the story to breathe a little bit, and it gives it time for character development and for further sort of delving into various parts of the story. It's wonderful that it's three. It makes so much sense. And, you know, they shoot so much footage. They just shoot so much footage, so it makes sense. I'm not surprised, you know.
It's not film these days. It's data that takes up all the space.
Yes, indeed.
What did you make of Martin's performance as Bilbo?
Martin is so wonderful. When I first heard that he was being considered for the role before he was actually cast, I was so thrilled. It, in my mind, I couldn't have really imagined anyone else to play the character. It's such perfect casting. And after seeing the film, he's brilliant. You know, he's the right amount of funny and. Sort of, he's got strange qualities, and then there's also real gravity to him and real heart. He's the heart of the movie, and he really pulled it off. It's beautiful. I'm so proud of him.
That first scene that he shot with Andy Serkis as Gollum, really, it was his first scene on the set.
Iconic. You know, to shoot the Riddles in the Dark sequence as your first jump into the world of The Hobbit, this iconic chapter. I mean, it was, as a child, it was my favorite chapter in any book that I'd ever read. So to start with that is so wonderful for both of them too, to kind of, for Andy to get back into that world of that character, and for Martin to sort of start to work on the character of Bilbo. It's beautiful.
High praise for actor Martin Freeman by Elijah Wood. who also talks about the decision to split the movie up in three parts instead of two. You think that was rehearsed, Inge?
Yeah, I don't know, because I totally believe him if he says, yeah, The Lord of the Rings is enough material for like six or seven movies, because there is. But the Lord of the Rings was three movies made of three books. And this is one book, very short book. So I'm not totally buying what he's saying.
But it was good what he said about the characters, and that it was
yes,
they were able to spend some more time on character development. And if I look at that interview with Philippa Boyens about what she said about a second movie having much more of Gandalf in it, I think that's actually that's encouraging. That's cool. Well,
would they just delve deeper into the Istari things? You know, just the great beings they are.
I don't know. What do you think, Dave?
I have no clue.
I think it's going to be interesting to see more of Gandalf's character if they can do it in a believable way.
Yep.
It will also, again, add more layers to his character, and thereby also perhaps to The Lord of the Rings. It's a bit similar to, and here comes the standard Star Wars reference, what the prequels did for the existing, episode 4, 5, and 6 of Star Wars. Once you know where Darth Vader comes from, his character, even though, you know, that story didn't even exist before those movies were made, it still has more depth and gets another dramatic layer, because you see more of the early motivations that led him to become the person that he was. And perhaps they will be able to pull the same thing off with Gandalf. Elijah Wood is very, very positive about Martin Freeman. There's another part of the interview which we'll get to that in our next episode with Martin Freeman, where they emphasize his kind of calmness in the middle of all that craziness that the dwarves bring about. He's kind of the calm center, and I personally never imagined Bilbo to be that calm. I always imagined him to be more nervous and you know, a little bit irritated by everything that happened to him. Do you think this is faithful to Tolkien's Hobbit story, Dave?
I think it's sufficiently faithful. I do think in some sense they have a little more leeway to innovate here than they did with Lord of the Rings, because Tolkien himself was in the process of rewriting it later in life, and
true,
that he basically ran out of steam and didn't do it. So
yeah. Well, we will see. I personally can't wait to see this movie. Now, I've learned that here in Holland, we will get to see it one day earlier than you, Dave.
Two days
earlier.
Wow.
It's premiering here on, I think, the 11th, isn't it?
12th. And
oh, 12th.
United States on the 14th.
Yeah, here it's like midnight on the 12th. Well, midnight between 11 and 12. So I'm not sure if I will be able to get tickets for that midnight premiere, but it is pretty cool. But next week, we will continue to talk about this whole red carpet premiere event. And especially, well, by then it will be old news. But we will be talking, just like we did today, about the implications of the interviews and what was said by the various actors. And we do get some little tidbits that might reveal us something about movies 2 and 3. And of course, we're very eager to know more about those, because that's what we're going to be talking about for the next year. I want to thank both Dave and Inge for taking the time to join me today here on The Secrets of the Hobbit. Dave, where can people find the Middle Earth Network stuff?
Middle Earth is mymiddleearth.com, and then of course there's also, people should check out mythgard.org for Corey Olson's stuff, and tolkienprofessor.com, and then my Twitter account is Dave Kale, DaveKale.
Excellent, and Ing and I are always on sqpn.com in many shows. Thanks for listening, and see you soon for another episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.